Last month in our worship group service, we looked at the first part of Paul's letter to the Galatians, and we thought about the context in which the letter was written, and we thought about some of the main themes. And today, following on from that, we're looking at the later part of that same letter, and we're looking to find another important theme which follows on from what Paul wrote about Christian freedom. As we know, in this letter, Paul was writing to relatively recently formed church communities in Galatia, and they were learning about the gospel in new ways. And as they received the gospel, it was as though seeds had been sown, and what mattered were the interests that influenced them, nurtured them, and then determined the harvest. And so Paul wanted to explain that if the Holy Spirit is the source of new life for Christians, then the Spirit must also be the guide for our Christian lives. Christian freedom doesn't mean that Christians are free to do exactly what they like. What it means is that Christians in Galatia, and us here today, of course, must think about others and must act towards them in Christian love. And so we see Paul here imagining two sort of rival powers contending for Christians. The Spirit, on the one hand, given by faith, and on the other hand, our fleshly desires, our human nature, what's called the flesh here. And for Paul, flesh and spirit represented two possible alternatives that give very different harvests in life. And of course, we've just read them the list of the two very different harvests. Now, like any harvest, the fruit of the Spirit takes time to develop into new patterns of life for Christians. There's nothing instantaneous about the freedom that Christ brings. Christian virtues aren't the prerequisite of salvation, they're the consequence of salvation. I think that's a very important statement there. For Christian virtues, we don't expect to have them all and then be okay to be saved or for God to love us. It's the other way round. They're the result of the fact that we learn about God's salvation and love. And what we have to do is to give ourselves to God's leading in trust, so that we let God work in us to develop those virtues, the ones which Paul lists there for us. We can't live a truly Christian life in our own strength. We need the strength and the guidance of God's Holy Spirit to produce good fruits ready for harvest in our lives. When we look at that list of the fruits of the Spirit, I'm sure we could spend a long time thinking about each one of those fruits mentioned, much longer than we've actually got this morning. So don't panic, we're not going to look at every single one today. What I want us to do is to pick out just three and think a little bit further about patience, peace, and humility. Maybe particularly patience and humility are ones that we don't think so much about usually. And for each one of those, I want to just think a little bit about a particular character to help us think about what they mean there. So let's start by thinking about patience for a few minutes. Patience is one of the fruits of the Spirit that we don't so often think about. When did you last hear a sermon on patience? Probably not for quite a long time. But fortunately for us, God's been very patient with his people. God's patience and his consistency can be seen all through the Old Testament in the stories of his dealings with the people of Israel. Over and over again we hear how the Israelites forgot God, let him down, disobeyed, and then how God forgave them and restored them yet again. And we see God's patience too in his dealings with individuals. Individuals who, quite often in the Old Testament story, were reluctant to do what was asked of them. If we think about just one of those individuals for a moment, think about the story of Gideon, which I'm sure some of you know well. Gideon was told by the Lord, "Go with all your strength and rescue Israel from the Midianites. I myself am sending you." And Gideon immediately gave God a series of reasons why he couldn't possibly do what he just asked him to do. And he asked for proof that God was the one sending him and would keep him safe and give him strength for the job. Until finally he tried testing God not once but twice by putting out a fleece and asking first that the fleece would be wet and the ground round it dry in the morning. And when that happened, he asked God to do it all over again, the other way round, the next day, just to make sure. I think that takes a lot of patience on God's part. And we know that God still shows this kind of patience with people today, even, fortunately, with people like us. He answers prayer. He helps us to cope with life's problems and difficulties. He forgives our disobedience and lack of trust. He never gives up on us, even though we may sometimes want to give up on him. The New Testament reminds us, of course, of our need for patience. Paul gives the picture of our Christian lives being like a race, and then he advises us that we should run with patience the race that's set before us. How can we actually hope to increase our patience as individuals and communities? Well, we obviously can't do it in our own strength. But one way in which God teaches us patience is when we do have to sort out problems and difficulties that we may have to cope with. It's often not so much what happens to us in life as how we react to it and how we deal with it. Listen to Paul's advice to the Romans on this. He said, "We can rejoice when we run into problems and trials, for we know that they are good for us. They help us to learn to be patient. And patience develops strength of character in us and helps us to trust God more each time we use it, until finally our hope and faith are steady and strong." I think too we can learn to be more patient when we remember that God is in control of us, in control of other people that we meet and have to deal with, and in control with all of his creation. If we really believe this, then we can ultimately leave things to God, and doing so takes away the need for us to be impatient. Whatever the job, the problem, or the situation, we can do what we can, and we can leave the rest to God, remembering, of course, that God works in his own time. We can't hurry God up because we feel impatient. That would be the opposite of what we're trying to think about. When we remember that God's in control, we free ourselves to concentrate on patiently doing his will. Now let's think about peace for a moment. And to help us do this, I want to use a small story of somebody who was known as, in fact, a peacemaker. When Jesus was preparing his disciples for the fact that he would be leaving them, they would have to face his crucifixion and resurrection, and so would he. He promised them peace. He said, "Peace is what I leave with you. It's my own peace that I live with you. Do not be worried and upset. We read in John 14. This peace of heart and mind is the peace which the Holy Spirit produced in the Galatians and still produces and grows in us today. It's another one of the fruits of the Spirit, and of course it's linked with the peace that we enjoy in the absence of fighting and arguing, conflict and war. Before anyone had heard about Christianity in the western part of the Solomon Islands, as in many parts of the Pacific, life was very far from peaceful. There was fighting, there was headhunting, there was cannibalism, and those things were a part of everyday life. And it must have taken a lot of courage for a young man called Hopper to be instrumental in bringing peace to one of those islands. Hopper was, of course, a Solomon Islander himself, and he left his island of Columbungra in the Western Solomons to go in search of travel and adventure around about 1895. And after working as a trader on a boat, he started to attend the mission school. Learning to read and write opened up, it seemed for him, even more possibilities for greater adventures. And at first he went to the worship services because that was what he was expected to do. But soon the story that the missionaries were telling him seemed to be important. And a long time afterwards, looking back, this is what he said. He said, "My life was like a boat. I was blown this way and that by every wind that came, whether it was good or bad. How I longed for an engine to put in my boat, so that I could go where I wanted to without worrying about the bad winds and strong tides. Then the power of the Holy Spirit came into my life through Jesus Christ, and I had my engine. I could now follow the right course." While Hopper was at school, Methodist missionary work had begun on the island of Choiseul, which was across the sea to the northwest of where his school was. They had a missionary from New Zealand, and they had two or three from Fiji and Tonga. But there were more requests coming from villages for missionaries than they had missionaries to go round. And one very persistent request came from the Senga district of North Choiseul. A leading man there came all the way to the school, and he asked the teacher for help for his people. And he said, "At least give me a student from your school who can come and help until we can get a missionary. I dare not go back with only words and not somebody to take." So Mr. Goldie, the missionary in charge of the school, thought about the problem. And he was quite worried. Who amongst the students of the school was going to be strong enough in that situation? Who wouldn't be afraid to risk his life to go to a place where it was known that people were fighting? Who would be able to help people to really understand the Christian way? And at least 9 of the students were considered before they came to young Hopper, who by that stage had been baptised with the baptismal name of John. And he was finally asked to go. And John Hopper agreed to go. He agreed immediately, in fact. There and then he went back to the house, packed his things in a small bag, and went off in the canoe with the leader from Senga. Now, of course, many courageous people had crossed those stormy waters from New Georgia to Choiseul Island in a canoe, but most of them had not gone with a total stranger like that. And he went to people whose language he didn't understand, and the only thing that he knew about them was that they were constantly at war with their neighbours. Not very encouraging. His friends and relations called him a fool. He didn't need them to remind him of danger, but he thought that he had the engine in his boat and he could do the right thing. His first test of courage came 12 days only after he reached his new home. There was news of fighting in the bush inland from where he was living, and John quickly set out with others for the place where the fighting was going on. The problem was, of course, that he only knew a few words in the local language. But when he reached the warriors all assembled for battle, he used three different Solomon Island languages that he knew, including his own, to try and persuade the men to go home. They just looked in amazement at this intruder, who was unarmed, standing between two warring tribes and talking to them in strange words that they didn't even understand. So they at least hesitated. And then one of the warriors stepped forward as though he was about to start the battle. And John stepped forward quickly too, and he just pushed the axe aside with his hand and said, "Stop!" And the man was so astonished, even though he didn't necessarily understand the word, that he thought John must have very powerful spirits on his side. And he came forward and he put down his sword, his axe and his shield at John's feet as a sign of surrender. And everybody went home. And John's street cred went up greatly amongst the people there. But that was just the beginning. That was only 12 days after he arrived. He couldn't even talk to people. That was the beginning of his missionary work. And there were many other occasions when people in the surrounding area came to attack the village. Well, many years passed, and it seemed that that problem of fighting would never go away. And once again, the enemies decided that they would attack the village where John was living. Now, by that time, some of the villagers had become Christians and a church had been built. And it was well known, not only in that village, but the other people around, of course, that at dawn every morning, the Christians gathered in the church for worship. And when they did that, the men would leave their weapons outside the door. And that was the only time of day when their weapons would be further away than they could reach with their hands quickly. So the enemy tribe decided that was their chance. And they decided on a July morning in 1919 that they would go, they would break into the village and they would surround the church. And that's what they did. They went quietly into the village as dawn was breaking. They surrounded the church, which they presumed was being used for worship as usual every dawn. And then they opened fire on the people in the church. You can do that quite easily through the walls if they happen to be leaf walls, which of course is what the church was built of. So they opened fire through the walls and got a shock, because that morning there was nobody there inside. For the first time in anybody's memory, John Hopper had overslept, and he had not called the people to worship early that morning. But of course, once the guns had been fired, the whole village was awake, and it was the enemy tribe who were in the middle and surrounded. And so, as the village woke up, they in turn attacked the enemy tribe, and the leader of the enemy tribe was in fact wounded and died later. A great victory? Well, possibly. Perhaps the most notable thing about it was that when the fighting was over, John took out his little stock of medicines and treated the wounded. He treated friends and enemies alike. And it wasn't until finally, in August 1912, that peace came to that part of Choiseul with a peacemaking ceremony, much to do with the work of John Hopper there, of course. And the story of the dawn attack has gone down in folklore in that area. I was talking to a friend quite recently, somebody who's not a Christian, and I shared not that story, but a similar story about from the Solomons. And it was a story about how Christianity had brought peace to the Solomon Islands. And I was very surprised by his comment. This is a retired history teacher who talked much about the history of the world to his students. He said, "That's interesting. You don't associate religion with bringing peace to a place. Religion usually causes fighting and wars." That's what he expected to hear. Well, it seems that peace is one of the fruits of the Spirit which we as Christians today are still urgently in need of developing in our lives and sharing with other people. And then thirdly, and finally, humility. This again is one that's not a very popular, I think, fruit of the Spirit, and not one that we always find easy. The person who particularly I think of when I think of humility is one of the characters from the New Testament, and that is Barnabas. The Barnabas who helped Paul in so many ways when he first became a Christian. Barnabas was a brave man who was willing to come to Paul's rescue when he arrived in Jerusalem after his conversion. You remember when he first arrived back in Jerusalem after his conversion, the disciples were all afraid of him for obvious reasons, and nobody wanted to have anything much to do with Paul of Tarsus. They wanted to stay out of his way. And it was Barnabas who went and introduced Paul to the apostles, told them about his conversion, and vouched for Paul so that he could become part of that early church. It seems that God delegated Barnabas to smooth the way for Paul, and Barnabas was brave enough to do just that. Barnabas was obviously well known and respected in the early church in Jerusalem. And when the good news was preached to the Gentiles in Antioch and the Gentiles were converted to Christianity, it was Barnabas who was sent by the church to investigate what was going on. He was described as a good man, full of the Holy Spirit and faith. And he was able to recognize God at work in Antioch. And again, he encouraged the Christians there to remain faithful to the Lord. He also went to Tarsus and encouraged Paul to go back and work with him in Antioch. He wasn't worried about his own leadership position, it seems. He was happy for Paul to share in the work. And his taking Paul to Antioch meant that they were both in the right place at the right time to be commissioned by the church there under the direction of the Holy Spirit to be sent out as missionaries to the Gentiles. Barnabas then, it appears, held a respected, important position amongst the Christians, being an encouraging friend to Paul when he needed one, and gradually bringing Paul into the work of the early church. Then they set off from Antioch on the first missionary journey, and they went first to Cyprus, which was Barnabas's home island. Much of the leadership and the initiative had so far always come from Barnabas. But very soon, as we start to read the story, we notice a change. And the text changes from reading about Barnabas and Paul to reading about Paul and Barnabas, or Paul and his companions. And from there on, Paul emerged as the leader. It looks as though, after all that Barnabas had done to encourage Paul, he was willing to step back, let Paul take the initiative, be the leader, and go on to be the great apostle to the Gentiles. I'm sure that for most of us it would be a very difficult thing to do. I've certainly found that one of the hardest things in life is to be willing to step back and let others go on further. As a parent or a teacher, watching a teenager that you've looked after and brought up, moving out into the world independently, allowing them freedom, even freedom to make their own mistakes and learn from them. Or in a work situation, when a new person comes in and you've helped and trained that person, and then you find that they are promoted ahead of you. Those are difficult situations to take, I think. For Barnabas to be able to do this for Paul, he must have had a great measure of God's grace and Christian humility. Are we, I wonder, like Barnabas, fully available for God to use for his purposes? Are we willing to be part of God's divine plan? And are we willing to be used for God's glory without considering our own ambitions, wealth, position, or power? I wonder.